If I have a title for the homily tonight, it would be Not Your Average Joe. I once heard a guy ask, why does Advent seem to be mainly for women and kids? Is that a fair question? How does a man relate to a manger? Why don't men's ministries have Advent evenings the way the women do? You know, have a cup of tea, do a teacup exchange, and then sing carols together. Well, maybe swap beer mugs and then have a seasonal winter lager. Sounds like I should give an altar call right now. Should guys feel disconnected? There are plenty of men who get in the story, and frankly, there are plenty of men in the story who get in the way. But many men still feel disconnected. Let's face it, this is a season of extraordinary and giddying disconnects. I don't know if this has happened to you again this year. It's happened to me. You're in a public place, and Christmas music is playing in the background. And as Mariah Carey belts out, "All I Want for Christmas Is You," you know she's not talking about Jesus. And then she sings, "Joy to the World, and Jesus is a Wonderful Child." And I always stand in disconnected disbelief that such truth being played out in the mall has slipped through the cultural censor's net. But the fact is that we are bombarded with seasonal disconnects between the temporary public appearance of religious form and the reality of continuous rampant private irreligiosity, between the virginity of the incarnation and the fornication of Christmas revelries and office parties, between heavenly choirs and drunken ones, between angels and elves, between holy, 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 and ho, 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 between the supernaturalism of divine conception and the unbelieving naturalism of biological explanation, between the purity and sanctity of a Savior's birth and the parental sentimentality of a Santa's grotto, between the one who for our sakes became poor and the many who for their own sakes have determined to become rich, between the prophetic and the pragmatic, between the manger and the mall, between the single divine word made flesh and the multitude of fleshly human verbiage, between the gift of salvation and our works of self-preservation. Frankly, a disconnect between heaven and earth. And when it comes to dissonances and disconnects, to be honest, the birth narratives are absolutely full of them. And as in a good mystery, things are said that cannot be fully understood at the time. Things happen that at first appear to be random until we watch the dots being sovereignly joined to flesh out an extraordinary visual of God, not just working among us, but actually among us, the incredible Emmanuel experience. And we learn pretty quickly in the story that God chooses and uses these characters regardless of how they had previously defined and described their lives. We were referring to this a couple of weeks ago in church. You hear their statements. I'm an old man. I'm barren. I'm a virgin. I will divorce her. And all of these self-designations are overcome by the inclusive grace of God that counts into his purposes those who had excluded themselves. Simply put, they're overwhelmed by the tender mercies of God. And he's still in the business of turning the graveyards of our dead expectations into the maternity wards of his purpose and will. He can take every initial response to his revelation, including yours, doubt, denial, even dread, and he can impart the gift of faith. Nothing looks good at first in this story, but as the text reminds us, it's not about our perceptions so much as it is about God's perspective. When he sees us as we really are, he sees nothing that is beyond the power of his grace and his love. And the fact is, as we often comment, Elizabeth needed more than a fertility clinic. And Joseph needed more than a good divorce attorney. And Mary needed more than a pregnancy test. And Zechariah needed more than a have faith message. The shepherds needed more than an invitation from the mayor to get them into town. And the wise men needed more than a star and more than Herod's help could give them. So thank goodness that the opening volley from heaven in this story is the one we still need most as the preface to our pursuit of God. Nothing is impossible with God. So the one who said, I'm past it, ended up saying, his name will be John. And the one who said, I'm out of here, ended up saying, his name is Jesus.
And the one who could have said, they're going to call me a tart, ended up saying, all generations will call me blessed. God connects the disconnects. And with amazement, we watch God at work drawing people with no sense of worthiness or readiness into the center stage of his gorgeous will. God seems to delight in getting together those who do not have it together. They seem to stumble into the story. And they stumble from every which way and every which angle. Some come suddenly and unprepared like the shepherd. Some come on a hunch like the wise men. Some come after years of longing and searching and waiting like Simeon or like an Anna. Some come with simple trust like Mary. Some come with joyful and relieved surrender like Elizabeth. Some come from a place of rank incredulousness and unbelief like Zechariah. And some come with initial doubt and rejection and with a struggle like Joseph. But come they do, and come you may in similar ways, but come we must. How did you come to Jesus? Which of the above do you most relate to? And if you've never come to Jesus, which of the above approaches best defines how you might be coming? For brevity's sake, let me just focus in on that last guy I mentioned and his way of coming to Jesus, his way of becoming connected. He's actually the very first of the disconnected, the unenlightened, the unprepared, that we meet in the very first gospel, so it's only fair to pick on him. After the opening genealogy in Matthew 1, Joseph is the guy being written about. And you might think, any name but Joseph, please. Ordinary Joe, average Joe, Joe Bloggs, Joe Schmo, Joe Blow, Joe Sixpack. What is it about Joe? Mr. Run-of-the-mill, middle of the road. Why not Mike or Bill or Jack? Why is it always Joe? Why me was certainly in Joseph's mind as these events broke out. Now, let's face it, this is hardly a great beginning. After all, this is not a fairy tale. We first find Joseph with his world in ruins. It's the ultimate horror. The girl of his dreams, the one he's engaged to and about to marry, is pregnant, and it's not his child. This is bad in any circumstances, but particularly in a Jewish culture, given the fact that engagement had the equivalence of marriage in the seriousness and solemnity of the covenant promised, and thus the use of the word divorce. Of course, Joseph would want to know who the father was. Of course, whoever it was would be the focus of both his disgust and his anger. Mary's attempts to console him with the news that it was God could not have helped. Not only immoral, she was now blasphemous and possibly insane. And as the implications of these facts broke in on him, what was his response? Deep sadness at being rejected? Anger for being cuckolded and humiliated? Deep shame for appearing to be the immoral fiancé who could not wait? Was this an inexpressible tragedy for him? Or was it a last-minute deliverance from one so promiscuous, irreligious, deceitful, and generally unstable? The total mix of shame and ridicule and disappointment is right in his face. Yet as we read the story, we know that everything he was reacting to that appeared so disastrous and unacceptable and so unbelievable was in fact the work of God. Surely, even if Joseph did for a minute allow the possibility that Mary was telling the truth, the problems are not solved. If the biology of it all was problematical, what of the theology? What on earth is God doing in heaven's name? God, whose eyes are meant to be too pure to behold evil. What is he doing messing with my virgin? This hardly looks pure. Joseph could be forgiven the thought that God, if he was for one moment possibly responsible, must be a terrorist of legitimate hope and longing. Why me? Why this? Why now? Why her? What are you doing? Who are you? What do you want of me? Any of those questions familiar to anyone? The ways and the workings of God don't always present themselves to us at first as tailor-made to our desires and our plans and our perceptions of what ought to be. The revelation of Jesus for this is exactly what this is all about for Joseph, was going to require some things of him, including things that would not conform to the expected norms of what was considered social or cultural or reasonable or appropriate. Think about it. The beginning of the greatest story ever told is outrageous and problematic. That a virgin would bear the Christ is shocking enough in terms of wrapping your mind around an immaculate conception. But Joseph's contemporaries were not going to come to that conclusion any more than Christ's. Can you imagine the humor down at the local hostelry when word got out that it was God? Immaculate indeed. Forever, Christ was going to be slurred as a bastard, bearing the ignominy and shame of illegitimacy in that culture. From the very beginning, his origins were in doubt. And the rumors of an unsolved and mysterious Christ, of strange dealings, of potential doubt, would continue to linger and challenge faith. So why am I indebted again this Christmas to the first guy on the narrative scene, to Joseph? Let me quickly suggest some reasons. First, I'm indebted to Joseph because I've only been reading the New Testament 2 minutes, and he teaches me how to respond to the workings of God that I cannot fathom immediately with my rational mind and my usual discernment and my savoir-faire. I really understand his initial response. Get out of there. Run. Don't touch it. Yet it is clear from the text, and oh, do we begin to see what God saw in him, that there was something about him that remained trustworthy even when his trust had been shattered. His motive for wanting to divorce her quietly, note, was to protect her from as much public disgrace as possible. He cannot cover her presumed sin. It will show soon enough. But he did try to cover her shame. And don't forget that he had shame of his own to deal with, not only because he was shamed by Mary, who he assumed had slept with someone else, but as we've already said, because everyone would assume that he had slept with her. His testimony was blown. His righteous life was tarred and feathered. And even 30 years later, we read in Luke 3:23, he was the son, so it was thought, of Joseph. Yet despite his own sense of public nakedness, he still tries to do what is right as possible, given how wrong everything appears to be. It's a mess. Could it get any worse? Are these the circumstances on which the salvation of the world hinges? Really? You got to love it. The worse the mess, the greater the miracle of redeeming deliverance. Precisely because it begins in a mess, I can relate to the process of recovery and discovery, because I do not begin my spiritual pilgrimage at a place of any more order or understanding than Joseph had. And the text simply says, after he'd considered this, an angel of the Lord appeared to him in a dream. He's in the middle of a living nightmare, and now he has a heavenly vision. It never rains, but it pours. Do not be afraid. This is amazing. This is first a word to him and about him before it's even about Jesus. How incredibly personal is the love and care of God that he should first console and comfort and confirm Joseph before proclaiming the main piece of pressing news. And of course, we know the message corroborated Mary's story. There's no record of a long conversation or of Joseph besieging the angelic visitor with questions in his own aggrieved defense. We read, he did what the angel of the Lord commanded him. Which was what exactly? To take Mary as his wife. But did that not confirm the public assumptions about his sexual guilt? Did he not seem to be taking responsibility for this child? In taking Mary, he took Jesus. Why do I love this man? This poster boy for godliness? Because he chose to identify with what God was doing, with who he was doing it with, regardless of how it looked or how it would affect his own public reputation or sense of personal dignity or his prospects. To accept Jesus, to accept salvation on God's terms, has always been about counting the cost, about running the risk of being considered a fool or a laughingstock by the watching world. Before it was ever said of Jesus that he humbled himself and took the way of no reputation, we see that modeled in his lowercase dad, his surrogate father. Again, we see what God saw in Joseph's heart all along, in the same way that God discerns the potential of any heart that is responsive to him and that will trust him and his word. The text says he awoke and he took Mary home as his wife. He could not have identified with God's work any more intimately than that. Didn't Jesus himself use that idea of being taken home by us as the image for intimate relationship with him? It was all a walk of faith that defied the odds. And in putting his arms around a pregnant Mary, he embraced the will of God beyond his understanding. And then he had to live with it in all its implications, day in and day out, watching that maternal bump get bigger and bigger. Or to put it another way, watching the purposes of God for him in Jesus Christ grow and grow. Then there is that most intimate of revelations. He did not know her until she had brought forth her firstborn son. So he had no sexual intercourse with her until Jesus was born. And don't forget that for 3 months of her pregnancy, she was apart from him with Elizabeth. This just speaks volumes of his voluntary, self-denying, God-preferring response to the will of God in a manner that put the purposes of God's work above his own, including legitimate ones. Why do I love this guy? First, because he teaches me to trust God beyond what my eyes see, beyond what my sense is telling me, beyond what my fears suggest, and beyond what the public demands. The second thing I love about him is that he becomes the first example in the New Testament of what a true disciple is really about. He's described as a righteous man. In other words, he did what was right by God's standards, regardless of the cost to himself, personally, emotionally, sexually. You cannot arrive at God's will for your life by choosing your own route. He models a walk of faith, again against the odds. He's everything that Jesus later described as a disciple. How much honor of Joseph was there in Jesus' presentation of what made for a man of faith? Little did Joseph realize in those early steps of bewildered obedience what it was that God was going to entrust to him. Would he later have said it was all worthwhile? Will you? Despite the hiccups and the stutterings and the deprivations and sacrifices and limitations and aggravations and frustrations that are the consequences of holy choices. It was not a cloistered walk for Joseph, for it was undertaken in the glare of village gossip, the scandal of shame, the mockery of others' cynicism. It was, in effect, the pioneering of the path. The child he would nurture would one day walk himself, like father, like son. You ask me why I love this guy? He teaches me what it means to walk by faith and not by sight, to be a disciple who seeks first the kingdom of God and his righteousness. The third thing I love about Joseph is that he got to name the kid. It's such an amazingly lovely touch in the script. When Jesus was born, it says, and he, that's our Joseph, and he gave him the name Jesus. Are you kidding me? If I was God, I wouldn't have allowed such a thing. There'd have been a light show in the firmament like no other, with a heavenly voice like no other, booming the name from the starry stratosphere, with a cohort of angels doing a flyby, and the name Jesus appearing in their exhaust. I would want no one to be in any doubt that he was my lad. But God of heaven defers to Joseph. It's unbelievable. Humility of the Godhead. And invites Joseph to specify what this boy is exactly. Now, if you'd spoken to Joseph a few months earlier, I think he'd have named these circumstances very differently, don't you? And in particular, he'd have named that fetus a number of choice and unkind and uncomplimentary things. Do you remember what you named your circumstances in life before you're aware of God's loving purposes for you? What are you naming your circumstances now?
your fear, your sense of threat, your dis-ease with a God who's getting too close for comfort. God invites us all tonight, as he did Joseph, to name these circumstances and feelings differently, to discern what's really going on. Oh, the stretch marks of faith, the discomforts of Christ. Years later, there'd be a similar set of circumstances for Jesus' disciples when they got caught in a storm out in Galilee. Some only named the circumstances a life-threatening storm. Peter saw the Lord in it. Why do I love this guy, Joseph? He teaches me to discern the work of God in my life and invites me to name what's going on as God's work and initiative pursuing me. There's so much in my life that did not rest well with me when I first perceived it. But later, I was able, because of Joseph's example, to name it as Jesus. Jesus wooing me, Jesus disciplining me, Jesus refining me, Jesus redeeming me, Jesus saving me. Now, I know that only 3 points is the customary limit, but I'm going to add a fourth as an addendum, somewhat related to the previous point. At one moment, Joseph was despairing of his life and future. What a change God brought to his life. What blessing followed when he surrendered to the Lord and listened and obeyed the word to him. He chose to cooperate with God against the odds. And here he was, prophesying this name over the child for the salvation of all generations. Why do I love this guy? Why is Christmas a guy's thing? Because Joseph shows me how God can take a faithless and fearful guy and give him a faithful and bold ministry. What an exchange. Who'd have guessed? Let me ask you something. Where does this Advent season find your life? Are there pains and struggles in walking out the will of God? Are you tempted to run and quit on the possible relationship with Jesus? Are you, in fact, being trusted by God with responses to his faith-stretching requests and requirements of you? Are things happening in your life that are anything but the dream circumstances you'd planned for? And frankly, it looks as if resolution is as far away as the delivery of that baby seemed to Joseph. Are you bearing shame and humiliation in the process? Are you having to learn, like Joseph, to continue to cooperate with God's pregnant purposes and trust his delivery date? Are you choosing to respond as Joseph did, righteously, not reactively, and in obedience do nothing less or more than what God has shown you, though it may neither feel nor look good? Is your character being tested and honed as Joseph's was? How would Joseph counsel you tonight, dear heart? I think he'd say, dearest, there is one simple and indisputable thing that makes it all worthwhile. Relationship with Jesus, a revelation of Jesus, the presence of Jesus in your life. Don't run. Don't check out. Don't doubt. Don't delay. Just come. Take him in. Take him on. You may be naming it many things right now, but it is the Lord. Amen.